I heard a story a couple years back of a famous YouTuber. The younger people in the audience will know him. If you're older, you won't ask somebody. It's okay. But his name is Mr. Beast. His name is actually Jimmy Donaldson. He has over 131 million subscribers on his YouTube channel. And he posts many videos, and most of his videos are him just doing kind of nice things for people. It's kind of a good channel to follow, good stories to see. Some of his content's a little bit here or there, but he does nice things for people generally. And in 2023, he posted a video on his channel that said, Mr. Beast cures 1,000 people of blindness. And this video generated millions and millions of views. And the gist of the video was that Mr. Beast worked with some eye surgeons to help 1,000 people who had been blinded by cataracts. These were people, young and old, all different places, from different countries even. And he worked with surgeons to help 1,000 people regain their sight. And the reason why people actually got mad at him, because the title of his post was, he cured blindness. He really didn't cure blindness. He helped people get some surgery to get their sight back. But he helped these people regain their vision. I thought it was a great thing to do, but he got hate for it, right? Like, who would hate somebody for doing something so nice for 1,000 different people? But if you were to watch the video, it was just so touching how older people who hadn't seen loved ones in decades, their faces, after the surgery, they were able to see their loved ones' faces, and they were just in tears. Young students who had never been able to get behind the wheel of a car now were learning to drive because their vision had been corrected. And it was just a touching video that reminded me, just like having physical sight changes everything, having spiritual sight and having your spiritual eyes open changes everything as well. That when God opens up your spiritual eyes, it changes how you see Him. It changes how you see your life. It changes how you see the world. And through this message today, my prayer is that you would begin to have open eyes to how God could work even in your pain, even in your limitations, even through your struggle, even through your trials, even through the things that are challenging in your life. My prayer is that God would open your eyes to see the potential of His work in your life. My prayer is that your view of pain and suffering would not be one of, I'm hopeless or I'm helpless or this is for nothing. God can never work in this situation. No, if you walk through those doors this morning with something heavy on your heart, if something kept you up last night, you couldn't sleep well, you've been dealing with anxiety or fear or something just wrestling in your soul, you have no peace because there's an issue dominating your life, I believe God brought you here today for this message to understand that when your eyes are opened spiritually, you could see the work of God in your life, because God transforms your seasons of pain into opportunities for Him to receive glory. Amen? In John chapter 9, Jesus is at the height of His popularity. He's been performing miracles. He's been teaching. As people hear His teachings, they're blown away at the things that He's saying. And during this time, there's something happening called the Feast of Tabernacles, which is at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So the Temple Mount is crowded every single day during this festival, and there's people there. Jesus and His disciples would go to the temple, and they would teach during the day, and He would perform miracles, and people were just being blown away by what He was doing. And at night, Jesus and His disciples would go up to the garden to sleep and to rest. Then the next day, they would come back in to teach. And during this festival, Jesus had already done some pretty amazing things. In John 8, you will remember that a woman was caught in the act of adultery, and they brought her out right there at the Temple Mount in front of the people. And Jesus, seeing the spiritual hypocrisy and the injustice of this moment, He intervenes and He tells those people who were there ready to kill this woman, ready to stone her to death. Jesus tells them, you know, let him who has no sin throw the first stone. And the people dropped their stones and they walked away shocked at what Jesus had told them. And now the authorities who were there are seeing Jesus and they're nervous. They're saying, this man is performing these miracles. He has this following. People are listening to him. Is he going to overthrow us? Is he going to want to take our power from us? So they begin to connive and find ways to try to catch Jesus in ways that would be illegal or unrighteous in their viewpoint. But Jesus has this following. And here in chapter 9, a whole chapter is dedicated to this one encounter that Jesus has with a man who was born blind. He didn't lose his sight because of cataracts, like in the Mr. Beast video. This was a man who had been born with blindness, and we see this miraculous encounter of how his eyes were opened physically, but more importantly, his eyes were opened spiritually. Beginning here in verse 1 of chapter 9, we're in the Gospel of John. This is what the Bible says. It says, as Jesus was walking along, he's here in the Temple Mount with his disciples, he saw a man who had been blind from birth. You need to understand that to the life of a blind person in the Bible, they were really put in a place where they had to rely on the giving of others for their existence. They were not allowed to work. They were not allowed to interact with other people. They were not really even allowed on the Temple Mount itself. They had to wait outside of the temple because people saw them as unworthy, as unwanted, as people not worthy of their time. And as they sat there, they would beg people to give to them so that way they could have food to eat or clothes for their bodies. And most of the time, they were just overlooked and people would just pass them by. And I would imagine that this man, for most of his existence, probably felt invisible. He felt like he wasn't seen. You know, they've spoken to many people who've studied the homeless, and on top of their physical needs for food or water or shelter, the issue that most homeless people deal with, the most broken parts of themselves, is that many homeless people feel that they are invisible, that people just pass them by, don't even look at them, don't even acknowledge their existence. And this man probably felt something similar to that, as day after day after day, he would wait for someone to drop maybe something into his cup or give him some food to eat. But I want you to notice a small detail here in verse 1. I want you to notice this, because this begins about how we can live with our eyes open. It says that Jesus saw him, that Jesus noticed him, that Jesus wasn't like everyone else who just passed this man by, but Jesus recognized him. He saw him. He noticed him. Here's the first thing I want you to understand. If you are going to be a person who lives with your spiritual eyes open, you need to trust that God is aware of your pain. You need to trust that God is aware of your pain, that he sees and that he knows what's going on in your life. Even in your unbelief, even in your desperation, even in your obliviousness, God is aware of what's happening in your life. The Bible makes it clear that God is omnipotent. That means God is in every place on this earth and everywhere at the same time. The Bible makes it clear that God is omniscient. That means he knows everything. And the Bible makes it clear that God is omnipotent. That means he has all power in his hands to move in your situation. And this man gets noticed by Jesus. Our God is a God who sees. Did you know that one of the names of God in the Bible is Elroy? Not Elroy like the name, but Elroy, the God who sees me. That name was given to him by this woman named Hagar. Hagar was a woman who was living in the desert with her infant son, ready to die. No food, no water, extreme heat, no hope. But God visits her in the desert, leads her to a well where there's water, and then gives her the next steps for life. And Hagar, because she was seen by God, she gives God that name. He is Elroy, the God who sees me. Did you know that God sees you? That God knows? You know, some of us have this idea that God's too busy. He doesn't recognize me. After all, who am I? No, the Bible makes it clear. You know, the psalmist says, who am I that you are mindful of me? Did you know that you're on God's mind? Did you know that God knows every detail of your life? Did you know that God holds in his hand every tear that you've cried, even the ones last night that kept you up, even the ones that you shed over your brokenness, over your shame, over the sin that you can't seem to overcome? Do you know God is aware of that? If we are going to be people who see God work through our suffering, you need to trust that God is aware of what's happening in your life. Look at Psalm 34:18. It says, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted, and he saves those who are crushed in spirit. You know, we fall into the trap sometimes of thinking that in my brokenness, that in my pain and in my suffering, that's when God feels the farthest away from me. It's the opposite. That's when God's his closest. That's when God is near. That's when God holds you and God uplifts you and God raises you up and says, I'm here with you. You're never alone. You're never forsaken. Did you know that God is aware of your pain? That's the first step. God notices this man. Jesus stops and he sees him. The disciples also see this man. Look at verse 2. They begin to have a discussion. And they say, Rabbi, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his own sins or his parents' sins? Jesus learns very quickly as they encounter this man that this man is not the only blind person there. These disciples are equally blind. Oh, they could see physically, but spiritually they're blind. Because where they would see an opportunity for Jesus to do something for this man, these disciples are not processing this as an opportunity for God to move in this situation. They're looking at this as an opportunity for a debate. Whose fault is this? You see, this question would have been asked in this time because both Jewish and Greek thought led a person to believe that suffering was caused by a person's sin. If you were an evil person, well, you're going to be having suffering in your life. And both Greek thought and Jewish thought led to this. So these disciples who were either schooled in Greek thought or Jewish religion, it would lead them to ask the question, Jesus, whose fault is it that this man is born blind? Now let's have a discussion about that, because does sin lead to suffering? Partially, yes. Partially, yes. Partially, no. Let's start with partially, yes. Sin has consequences. The Bible makes it clear, do not be deceived. Whatever a man reaps, that will he also, whatever he sows, that he shall also reap. So if you sow sin, you sow rebellion against God, you're going to reap the consequences of that sin, and you will have some suffering in your life as a result of your sin. But you could be a righteous person and also suffer. The Bible makes it clear in 2 Corinthians that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. And because the rain falls on the just and the unjust, you could be a just person and you could still deal with suffering. Why do the just deal with suffering in this world? Well, because we live in a broken world. Suffering and pain was never part of God's plan. But in Genesis 3, when sin entered into the world, then brokenness entered into the world. And as a result of that brokenness, whether you're righteous or you're not, you're going to have suffering in your life. Jesus suffered. Jesus said, in this life we will have trouble, but take heart because I have overcome the world. But back to this question, they're asking Jesus, whose fault is it? Is it his fault or is it his parents' fault? And they're asking the question, why? And let me just say this, it's okay to ask why. If you were up last night asking God why am I enduring this? Why is my life in this point right now? Why do I have this physical pain in my life? Why am I stuck in a broken, loveless marriage? Why can't I seem to find a good job? Why is my child hooked on drugs? Why did I lose this loved one? Can I just affirm you this morning and say, keep asking God why? God is big enough to handle your why questions. People might not be big enough for the why questions, but our God is big enough. And listen, in his grace and in his sufficiency, he will provide the answers to those questions, if not in this lifetime, in the one to come. But these disciples weren't asking the genuine question why. They were playing the blame game. And when we play the blame game, we end up missing the God opportunities, because the man did not need the police there to figure out what happened to him and what led to his blindness. The man did not need a police. You know what the man needed? He needed an ambulance. He needed help. They were going to Jesus with the wrong heart. Instead of saying, Jesus, how can we help this man? They were saying, Jesus, why is he like this? But Jesus answers the question in verse 3, and he says, it was not because of his sins or his parents' sins. This happened, now catch this, so the power of God can be seen, can be exhibited, can be put on display in him. Now thank God that Jesus clarifies that this man's blindness was not a result of his parents' sin, because if it was, our kids' zone would be chaotic right now. And all of us would be blind in here because you know your parents. So Jesus clarifies and he says, look, it's not that this man is suffering. And this is an incredible statement that Jesus says here. He's saying this man is suffering so that the power of God could be manifest, could be exhibited, could be displayed, could be seen through his suffering. And this leads me to my second point. The first point, to live with open eyes, is trust that God is aware of your situation. The second point is this: trust that God can move even in your pain, that God could work even amongst your pain, your challenge, your issues. Trust that God could work on that. Jesus says he is suffering so that my power could be put on display, so that I could exhibit my power within him. How many know that in sports there's things called exhibition games? I took my son about 10 years ago to see Team USA. This was the basketball team for Team USA, and it was probably the greatest basketball players on the planet on that team. I mean, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, the list would go on and on and on. These were the best players in the planet. Now, this game didn't count for anything. They weren't keeping stats. They didn't care how many points they scored. They didn't even care who won the game. They were playing Venezuela. I mean, that's not a powerhouse basketball team, but it was an exhibition. It was a display. It was a way to put the team on show so that the crowd could look and say, wow, look at how great this team is. Wow, look at how strong Team USA is. And man, they put on a great show because it was an exhibition. Did you know sometimes God will have you in a place of suffering so that he could put on an exhibition in your life, so that the people around you who know you, who are walking through the challenging moments of your life, can see the power of God in you, work within you, and look back and say, wow, look at how great our God is. This changes things. This is opening the eyes of this man. This man, his eyes weren't open physically yet, but spiritually, I'm sure this was beginning to do something within him, because he was blind, but he was not deaf. He heard Jesus say this. This now validated his suffering. This now gave reason to the pain that he was going through, that he was enduring. Now he had a reason to say, God, you're using this for something. This is not for naught. And that's the beginning of living with eyes wide open. Now, you might be asking yourself, how could God use pain and suffering for my good, for anyone's good? I mean, how could God do that? Here's three ways. The first way that God could use pain or suffering is to equip you to give comfort to someone else. In the book of 2 Corinthians, it says, praise and glory be to our God, the God of comfort, who provides us with comfort. After us receiving comfort, now we are able to comfort others. Do you know what the greatest training ground is for being able to minister to people who are suffering and in pain? For you to go through suffering and pain. Jesus was able to minister to those who were broken, to those who are suffering, because he himself suffered. And God could use your moment of pain, of loss, of tragedy, of challenge, to equip you to comfort someone else. God could use your pain and suffering to strengthen you. In the book of James, it says, consider it all joy, brothers and sisters, when you endure, when you live through pain and suffering and trials of all different kinds, because this produces in your life. What does it produce? It produces perseverance. It produces patience. It leads to maturity. It leads to strength. God could use pain and suffering to correct you, to bring you back on course, to live in a way that's right for him. C.S. Lewis says this about pain in his book, The Problem of Pain. Profound statement. He says, pain insists upon being attended to. You cannot ignore pain. You cannot ignore suffering. Sometimes when everything is going well, we could be asleep at the wheel. But if you're in pain and you're suffering, it demands that you attend to it, that you put your mind to it, that you pay attention to it. God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us through our conscience, but God shouts to us through our pain. God shouts to you in your pain. It's a reminder to come to him, to bring it to him, to help him bear it with you. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. It's his way of waking you up that you need him. It gives the only opportunity, listen to this, it gives the only opportunity to bad people can have for change. What is it that brings sometimes the worst of humanity to their knees before God is the pain that they're going through. It removes the veil. Pain is the great equalizer. It rains on the just and it rains on the unjust equally. And his last statement, it says, it plants the flag of truth within the fortress of the rebel soul. Even the most wayward person, even the most farthest person from God who endures pain can be brought back to the center. The most rebel of souls can have the flag of truth planted into their being, because God uses pain. God works through suffering to bring people to himself. The man didn't know what was about to happen. The disciples surely didn't know, but Jesus knew what was about to happen. This man's pain was about to become the stage for God's work. And listen, maybe you're here and you've been in darkness. Your spiritual eyes have been closed recently. Maybe you've been feeling far from God, or you can't hear his voice. Your mind has been closed to his work, to his doings in your life. Be awakened this morning. Be awakened. Trust that God could work even through your pain. So this man is hearing this whole, they're having a whole conversation about him. He's blind, but he's not deaf. He could hear. Jesus continues teaching in verse 4. He says, "We must quickly carry out the tasks assigned to us by the one who sent us, because the night is coming and then no one can work." What is Jesus saying here? He's saying, you know, he's telling the disciples, look, you guys are lost. You're wasting time on debates when we should be trying to help this man, because you only have your lifetime to do this work. Once you die, you can't do this work. And did you know that in heaven, there's going to be no prayer circles in heaven? Did you know that? There's going to be no healing campaigns in heaven. People aren't going to be sick in heaven. No one's going to need prayer in heaven. There's going to be praise in heaven, but there ain't going to be any prayer in heaven, because everything's going to be right up there. And Jesus is saying that's when night comes. When night comes, you can't do this work then. You got to do this work during the day while you're alive here on earth, this earth where there's pain and there's suffering and there's opportunity for you to move on my behalf. Do the work during the day. Don't wait till night. Verse 5, he says, "But while I am here, I am the light of the world." Then look at verse 6. Jesus does something very strange. He spit on the ground. He makes mud with his saliva, and he spread the mud over the blind man's eyes. Did you know there's no culture on earth? There's no tribe. There's no people. There's no group who elevates the presence of spit. Universally, every culture sees spit as a sign of disrespect, as something disgusting, and as something vile. Why in the world would Jesus choose this method to heal this man? Jesus was God. Jesus could have spoke the word and the man could have got his sight. Jesus could have put his hand on his head. Jesus could have had the thought and kept walking and healed the man. Why did he choose to do it in this way, where most people would look around and one say, "What is he doing?" And the second thing they would say is, "Why spit?" Jesus was using something that no one would confuse as able to do this work except for him. Jesus was already teaching a lesson that this miracle that was about to happen, nothing could receive the glory from it, because he was going to use something so vile and so low to prove just how powerful he was. This blind man is quiet. I wonder what he was thinking as this was happening to him. Do you know sometimes when you encounter a move of God, things just don't make sense? And you have a choice during that moment. Am I going to go with this, or am I going to rebuff God because I think I know better? I've known drug dealers who have fallen under the conviction of God, who have gone to their house after a prayer meeting and have taken thousands of dollars worth of drug products and have flushed it down the toilet because they were under the conviction of God. It made no sense why they did it. Just hours before then, they were using those products, they were selling those products, but they fell under the conviction of God, and it's something that just made no human sense. God did something in their life. I've known alcoholics who've emptied hundreds of dollars worth of booze down the toilet, flushed it, and seen it go down a drain. Why? Because they encountered God. I've seen youth after youth retreats and youth prayer meetings take vape pens and bags of marijuana and other drugs and paraphernalia, and live on their social media, they've posted this live for their friends to see, for their parents to see, many of them who never even knew they were on these things, and they're there putting these things into the sewer on the city streets of Chicago. Why? Because they had fallen under the conviction of God. Sometimes the things of God will not make sense in your life, And you will have a choice. Do I rationalize it? Do I try to figure out? Or do I say, God, you're doing something here. Let me go with what you're doing. We're talking about having your eyes open. Sometimes breakthrough requires faith that God will work in your life even at the lowest point and even if it doesn't make sense. Now, if you thought the mud in the eyes was an outrageous command, look at what Jesus tells him next to do. In verse 7, he tells him, he says, go wash yourself in the pool of Siloam. Siloam is the Hebrew word meaning sent. That's key there because Jesus is sending him to a place because he's saying, I am the one sending you there. You are walking to this pool under my authority. Not under your own authority, but under my authority. I am the one sending you on this walk. Now, we need to understand something. This man is still blind. He had let his life regulated to this little corner, and now Jesus is saying, walk. Walk blind. The pool of Siloam was a quarter mile away from where the Temple Mount was. A quarter mile away, walking blind with mud in your eye. Why would Jesus do this? You see, this is what Jesus does. To open your eyes, you need to respond in obedience to God's prompting. You need to respond in obedience to God's prompting. God is prompting this man. He's saying, go walk to the pool, wash, and then come back. He's got to walk blind a quarter mile with mud in his eyes. The steps, this is so big. This is so big. Because this is the point where most people stop. And they say, God, you're too much right now. I don't have it. I can't do it. And this is where people flake out. And you know what happens? They miss their miracle. They miss the breakthrough. This is the moment where most people say, no, I can't do it. Because what was Jesus really telling this man to do? He tells this man to do what he tells many of us to do when he asks obedience of us. Jesus is undoing years of lies. He's undoing years of pain and of hurt and of shame and of embarrassment. And he's undoing old ways of thinking. He's undoing old ways of believing in this man. You see, this man, his whole life, people had told him, you don't belong here. You're unworthy. You're worth nothing. You're nobody. You're going to be bound to blindness for your whole life. You'll never amount to anything. This man's whole existence had been a roll of lies that had been fed to him. And now Jesus is challenging him, walk back through those lies. Because what do you think this man was going to hear as he had to walk through a crowded Temple Mount for a quarter mile with mud in his eyes, still blind? You know what the people were going to be saying to him? What's this guy doing? Look at this fool. Not only is he blind, but he's got mud on his face. This guy must be out of his mind. Jesus is challenging and testing his faith to say, will you believe people and what they've spoken over you? Or are you going to believe in the one who sent you? And this was the moment of truth, church. And in your life, hear me well, hear me well. Your life will come to a moment where you're going to have a moment of truth. You will either walk in obedience to what God has called you to do, or you will stay stuck in the lies, bound to what people have spoken over you. This is hard. I imagine how hard it was for this man to do this walk. It required him abandoning his pride. That's hard. It required him abandoning his agenda. That's hard. It required him making himself vulnerable to the words of others. That's hard. It required him not knowing where this was going, not knowing how this was going to end. That's hard. It required him releasing control of his situation and giving it to God. And listen, hear me well, that's hard. Obedience is hard. But when you know the one who sent you, it makes it just a little bit more bearable. And I imagine with every blind step that this man took, he said, he told me to come. He told me to come. He told me to come. And as he kept saying that, maybe perhaps his faith was growing. And now he wasn't focused so much on what people were saying about him or saying to him, but now he was focused on the one who sent him. Yeah. Do you know, 20 years ago, they found this pool. That's why I love the Bible, man. They found the pool. It's right there. You can see it. It's dry. When it rains in Israel, the pool will fill up with water. And you know what people do? Woo! They jump right in. You could only see a corner of the pool because they built a town over the other half of this pool. But this pool would extend probably several hundred feet to the right. This is just one edge of the pool there by the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. But they found this pool 20 years ago, and it's open to the public. And it's a reminder of people of steps of faith, of obedience, to say, God, I desire you more than anything in this world. And if you're the one who sent me, I will go because I know the doors will open for me. You know what trips me out? Here's what trips me out. I see people have more faith and trust in the automatic doors at Target than I do with the God of the universe. And it just trips me out. You park your car at Target. Beautiful red doors are there. Glory is waiting for you on the other side of those doors. You make your way out of your car. Starbucks is in there. I've never seen anyone walk up to those red doors like this. No, we just walk so happily through them. Why? Because we trust that they're going to open and you could get to your glory. Automatic doors. Some human invention runs on electricity. We trust that more. But when the God of the universe, who hung the stars in its place, the God who dug the oceans, the God who shaped the mountains, the God who put all the chemicals in their exact order so that life could grow and thrive on this planet, when the God who's existed for eternity past to eternity future, when that God asks you to do something, you know how we approach his doors? We don't trust. This man knew the door was going to open for him because he trusted. He trusted. He walked in obedience to what God was calling him to do. And it just reminds me of the people who flake out in this moment. They want the miracle. You know what they don't want? They don't want the mud. They want the wonders of God. They don't want the work. They want the breakthrough. They don't want the boldness to take the steps required of it. And listen, if you're going to see your eyes open sincerely to the things of God and see God do miraculous things in your life, it will require, it will take bold steps of obedience every time. If you're looking for an easy, cheap miracle, our God is not the God for you. His miracles are neither cheap nor easy. This man is walking and he's saying, I know who sent me. And his healing is complete. The Bible says he comes back seeing. Imagine the moment. His eyes open. He sees the first human face he's ever seen. The man was born blind. The rooster that he heard every morning, now he sees it. And he says, you're the thing that's been waking me up every morning. He sees his hand. He sees himself. He sees the sky, the birds. Imagine that moment for this man as his physical eyes have opened. For the first time, he's living life as God intended him to be. And here's what we learn from verse 8. When you're living life the way God intended you to be, not everyone will be happy. Not everyone will be happy. Look at verse 8. His neighbors and others who knew him as a blind beggar asked each other, isn't this the man who used to sit here and beg? Verse 9. Some said he was, and others said, no, that just looks like him. Funny, right? Like, no, that's, it can't be him, man. There's no way this dude could see. Look at him. He could see. The other guy couldn't see. That can't be him. It just looks like him. But the beggar kept saying the first words from the beggar's mouth. First time we heard him speak. He says, yes, I am the same one. When people want to doubt what God has done in your mouth, keep speaking. Keep speaking. Because not everyone will be happy that you're healthy. Not everyone will be happy that you're whole. Not everyone will be happy that you finally understand your purpose in life. It's not that you're perfect. It's not that you're all together. It's not that everything has been fixed with you. You will never, ever be fixed. But now you know what you're living for. And now you know who your God is. Now you know your identity. And some people will not like that. This was no longer the broke, busted, and disgusted fellow in the corner of the temple. This was a man who was whole now, walking in a newness of purpose because he had encountered Jesus. And these people just couldn't deal with that. They preferred the broke down, busted, disgusted version of this man because they could manipulate that man. They could speak down on him. They could ridicule him. They felt superior to him. And now that he was healthy and whole, now they're afraid and they're intimidated and they're so insecure in themselves that they say, oh, this can't be the man. When you encounter God, not everyone will be happy. Just know that. When you stand in faith with God, you will create opposition in the world and people will hate on you. And here they're hating on him, and they're saying, there's no way that this could be him. And look at verse 10. They asked him, what happened? Who did this to you? Verse 11, I love what he says here. He says, the man. He doesn't mean the government or some system, not that man. When they said, what happened to you? And my prayer is that when people ever ask you, because some people look at you and you've changed so much. Some of you here, you are not the same person you were in high school. You're not the same person you were growing up back in the day. God has done such a great work in your life that you might encounter people from back then. They won't even recognize you. And they're going to ask you, what happened? My prayer is that you would say, the man. The man who? He says, the man they call. He made some mud. He spread it over my eyes, and he told me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash yourself. And I went, and I washed myself. And now I could see the simplicity, but yet the power of this testimony. This is who I was before. This is the man I met. This is my life now. This encounter here, for the next 30 verses, you can read it for yourself. A whole big fight happens. Everybody's fighting. The family starts fighting. His friends are fighting. His neighbors are fighting. The Pharisees get involved. They start to question him, interrogate him, berate him. They want him to say, no, it wasn't Jesus who healed you. This had to be something else. Then they even start doubting that he was even blind to begin with. They bring his parents in and they say, is it true that he was born blind? And the parents are like, look, man, the dude was born blind. It's just how it was. They're saying, no way, it can't be, because Jesus is a sinner. No way Jesus could do this miracle. Ain't no way. Tell us it was something else. Tell us it was anything but Jesus. Look at what the Pharisees said. They're so religious. Verse 24, it says, for a second time, they said, look, come, blind man, come. You know, we want to give God the glory for this miracle, but not Jesus. Obviously, this was God, right? Tell us, please, it was God. Because Jesus is just a sinner like us. And it seemed the more they tried to make this man recant and renounce the miracle of Jesus, the more he dug in, the more firm his conviction to say, look, no, look. Look at verse 25. I love the heart of this man. He says, I'm not going to debate you. I'm not going to give you some scientific explanation. This isn't going to come up in the Christian Science Monitor, you know, edition tomorrow morning, how this happened with a break-by-break breakdown of what Jesus did to heal me. He says, look, I don't know. I mean, no, it's okay to say sometimes, I don't know. I don't know what God did in my life. All I know is he did it. He says, I don't know whether this man is a sinner, but I know this. I used to be blind. Now I can see. You do with that what you want with it. He never gave in to the pressure. For another 9 verses, they go at it again. And then in verse 34, the Pharisees have finally had enough of this guy. And they have no choice. This is what manipulating people will do in your life. When they can't convince you otherwise, they'll always take you back to the original kind of like, dig. And here the Pharisees are out of playing cards. They have nothing else left. Like, well, I guess the only thing we could go back to is the original lie we said about this guy. So they said, you were born a total sinner. You are trying to teach us. Some of you caught that. And they threw him out of the synagogue. Threw him out. Said, you're not worthy to be among us holy people. You and your kind, get out. Because when they can't put anything on you, they will always go back to the original lie that they spoke over you. And they put the man out. And here's the last thing I want to share with you about living with your eyes open. One, you got to trust that God sees you. He sees you. Two, trust that God can work in your pain, and he will. Three, respond in obedience. It's required. Four, trust that your true identity is never found in people. It's found in God. They had nothing left but to go to the same thing that people always play to try to break you, your identity, that you're worth nothing, that you're nobody, that nobody cares about you, you're unlovable, you're just going to be this hype or this addict and this person who's not worth anything. That's all they had left. Now, again, the man had a choice. Am I going to believe the lies of people, right? I'm going to believe in the one who sent me. So let's see how this works out, because this man has just been rejected. And listen, like I said, when you make a stand for God in your life, you should expect some rejection. There's two kinds of rejection. There's a rejection that's a result of bad choices and bad relationships. And sometimes if you're in toxic relationships and toxic people and you make bad choices, you're going to suffer rejection from people. That's one type of rejection. There's a rejection that's more, I would say, divinely given. And sometimes that rejection hurts just as much as the human rejection. But later, with time, you begin to understand why you endured that rejection. And sometimes God will have people reject you because he's trying to protect you from those toxic people. And here, these religious zealots, these hypocrites, who were putting this man down. This man did not need those people in his life, so they rejected him. And you know what? That was God-given. God cut that. So God could use rejection to protect you from people who are just going to be toxic in your life. God could use rejection to grow your faith to trust him. God could use rejection to align your heart with him first. Seek first the kingdom of God. Then all the other things will be added unto you. But this man is still rejected, and I imagine in his heart, what should have been a moment to celebrate, he's now broken again. But Jesus steps in. Look at verse 35. When Jesus heard what had happened, he found the man. Oh my God, oh my God. The smallest word makes the difference. Did you catch that Jesus found him? You know what that implies? Jesus went to look for him. Jesus heard what happened. He could have been like, oh, well, that's tough. He could see, though. No. He knew his job wasn't complete. And what did Jesus do? He went and he found the man. He looked for him because he sees you. You see, sometimes we could skip over a simple word like that and we lose the meaning of the heart of the text. Jesus found the man because he cares for him. Because he's concerned for him. Then he says, do you believe in the Son of Man? The man answered, who is he, sir? I want to believe in him. Insane. This man had just been miraculously healed. And he still doesn't know who Jesus is in front of him? Jesus had every right to be like, dude, I'm done with you. How could you not know? But because Jesus is patient, he's loving, he's kind. He's long-suffering. He doesn't cast the man away. And again, don't miss the word, because one word here changes everything, the meaning of the text. Verse 37, Jesus says, you have seen him. Did you notice what Jesus did? The Pharisees had just called this man a born sinner. Jesus is contradicting the lies that man has spoken over him with the truth of who he was in Jesus. You are a person who's healed, who's whole, who sees. the Messiah. That one word was his identity spoken over him. He said, you are the one who's seen him. I've done this work in your life. And he is the one speaking to you now. Verse 38, yes, Lord, the man says, I believe. And he worshiped Jesus. Literally, 10 words before this, he was questioning, who is this man in front of me? But because his identity was spoken over him, he now falls in worship. A man whose eyes had been opened physically since he came back from the pool, here Jesus opens up his eyes spiritually. And the man, for the first time, understands who he is in Christ. And what does that cause him to do? How many know that when you really know who you are in him, and when you begin to understand just everything that he's done for you and your possibilities of life when you live for him, you can't help but to fall and to worship him. You can't help but to fall into worship. But the same question the man was asked in verse 35 by Jesus, do you believe in the Son of Man? That's the same question I'm asking you this morning. Do you believe that Jesus sees your pain, can work in your pain? Will you respond in obedience to the step that he's taking you to take? And will you find your identity in him and his truth and who he says you are and not what man says you are? Could we stand together? I'm going to invite the word.